Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Coming up, we dig out a couple of the most disturbing stories in the world that you won't see in the Evening Post or here on the BBC. Why are so many people saying the 7-7 inquest is going on in London is a sick travesty of justice? And what about the well-known company built on Nazi money, which is thriving in Britain today? And musicians on the music industry. Can you make music to a formula in a factory, like you make sausages? Well, Bristol and Britain are both known for our musicians, but does the industry give them a break? Or have the forces of darkness got their fangs into the business? And if you can get through that lot, we lighten up for a close look at a hidden advice about how to deal with the banksters, subtly codified into that old MGM favourite, The Wizard of Oz. But first, what is Halloween? Well, it's on Sunday night, the 31st of October, but apart from being the one night of the year when it's cool to be evil, supposedly, the word is a shortened version of All Hallows' Eve, the night before November the 1st, which is All Saints' Day, or Hallowmass, which was a Christian feast day when payments were due, and a holiday, first celebrated in the year 835 AD. All Saints' Day is where every Christian in the last two millennia who's risked their life or died for spreading the gospel and following Christ's teachings is honoured. It's followed the next day, on the 2nd of November, by something called All Souls' Day. All Saints' Day roughly coincides with the pagan pre-Christian cross-quarter day of Samhain, which many believe is All Saints' Day's true origin. Samhain occurs between the 5th and the 10th of November, and it traditionally is when an assessment is made of the success or otherwise of the year's harvest, and winter begins. Anyway, on to our Halloween stories. Firstly, the 7-7 London bombings inquest horror story. The present inquest into the deaths of 52 people that died as a result of explosions on the London transport system on the 7th of July 2005 does not include the four alleged bombers. And we have some key points from reporter Adrian Connock. We've had confirmation that there's no footage of these alleged bombers on the platform of London Underground, despite all the CCTV cameras all over the place. In other words, there is no footage of them getting onto the tubes that were bombed. This contradicts earlier police statements that implied the footage of the men actually boarding the tubes existed. The police originally talked of an iconic image of the four men hugging before separating at King's Cross, but had not actually, this has not been produced at the inquest, and therefore suggests it may never have existed at all. Bizarrely, CCTV footage from King's Cross McDonald's cuts off shortly before the time alleged bus bomber Hasib Hussein is supposed to have gone in. So why was that? It has at least been officially confirmed that the cameras on the bombed number 30 bus were not in operation that day, so that's why they're saying that there was no CCTV footage from the bus. London Underground Network Control Centre recordings have been heard in court, and they reveal more references to explosions possibly coming from underneath the carriages. Another point, the alleged bombers' phone records have been revealed in court for the first time, but incredibly, they have not been disclosed for the date of the attacks, only the previous days. Reports of communication with the alleged supplier of the explosives and mastermind Haroon Aswat remain unconfirmed. Text messages reportedly from Khan to Lindsay, they were two of the alleged bombers, are couched in terminology such as big knackers and do not fit the characteristics of Islamic suicide bombers, as they are supposed to do. Regular use of the F word and countless foul-mouthed expressions, of which we cannot repeat actually any of them here, suggest the records have been switched, or, at the very least, that Mohammed Siddiqui Khan was not a Muslim. There's a new July 7th Truth Campaign dedicated inquest blog at 77inquests.blogspot.com. That's 77inquests.blogspot.com, which is very critical of the way that the inquests are being conducted and extremely suspicious about the official version of events that day. And you can find a very different official inquest website at 7julyinquests.independent.gov.uk. So thanks very much to Gloucestershire filmmaker Adrian Connock for that report. And we'll have more from Adrian about the 7-7 bombings inquests next week. Now, when Alex Isigonis first designed the Austin Mini back in the 1960s, little did he know that 40 years later a redesigned Mini would be released by a company financed with money made through slave labour from Nazi concentration camps. When German family-owned firm BMW took ownership of the old British Leyland Cowley motor plant in Oxford, no questions were asked about the money, where the money came from. The fact is that the Quant family, who owned BMW, made a fortune during World War II in factories largely run on slave labour, brought to the factories every day by Hitler's hated SS. Günter Quant joined the Nazi Party in 1933 and quickly went to work in the armaments business. The Quants owned a company called AFA, which was renamed Varta after the war. It manufactured heavy batteries for submarines, tanks, ships and aircraft, and also the V2 rocket for Hitler's war machine. 15 years after the war, the Quant family sold up and reinvested their substantial wealth in a relatively unknown firm, BMW, hoping no one would follow the money trail. Günter Quant's wife also remarried into the notorious Goebbels family, and if you thought that there was animosity there, then you're wrong. Joseph Goebbels adopted Quant's son Harold, and Adolf Hitler himself acted as a witness at Harold Quant's wedding. Goebbels, of course, is widely thought to be behind the bringing in of the so-called final solution, Hitler's extermination plan for Europe's Jews. So, next time you see a BMW Mini, you could be forgiven for seeing it as made with a considerable amount of help from unrepentant Nazi money. And as if that was not enough, while all the other German car manufacturers who contributed to the Nazi war effort, like Mercedes, Porsche and Volkswagen, have put tens of millions of pounds into compensation funds for the families of the concentration camp victims, at least until a controversial film premiered this time last year on German television called The Silence of the Quants, BMW's Quant family had neither acknowledged their Nazi roots nor contributed to the fund, despite their estimated family fortune of about £17 billion. Now, on to the music industry. And can you make music like to a formula, like in a factory? Well, because Friday night is music night, let's discuss the music industry now. And I'm joined by two Bristol musicians, actually three Bristol musicians, as well as Michael Jenkins from BCFM's controversial, typical, topical, Afro-tropical news show. Now, first, hi, Michael Jenkins, and welcome to Drive Time.
Yeah, hi, Tony. How's everything going? Good show.
Thank you. Now, can you tell us, first of all, what the typical, topical show is about and when it's on?
Yes, it's a show which is it's on every Thursday, 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock on BCFM 93.2, and it's just like it's a debate show where we have discussions about certain topics which are in the media for that week, and we just put our take on it and how we see it, and like just explain how everything is not as it seems and how they put it and how they portray it to you. Like,
so what sort of music do you do?
I make like hip hop music. Like I'm a spitter and a producer. Like a spitter, that means like a rapper, someone who like I make lyrics and I make songs with other people as well. And yeah, that's what I normally do.
Now, for a lot of people, they see hip hop as something that's quite aggressive. Would you say that's true?
I mean, it's portrayed as aggressive. It is aggressive because there's a lot of emotion within hip hop. I mean, it's how hip hop started is like telling the world about problems and situations that people go through on a day to day basis. So it's like it's as aggressive as you are in real life, like, you know.
Now, also joining me is Tim Herford from the local band The Transpersonals. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Tony.
Now, what are your thoughts about the music business? Because your band hasn't got a record deal, has it? Don't you think maybe you're just a little bit bitter about not having signed you?
Well, we've got like a sort of a DIY indie deal with a bunch of guys at Left Warners, because they were fed up with the big business, music business as well. But everything we do is really, really DIY. It kind of has to be, do you know what I mean? We've made our album on a budget of zero, with the help of producers, and, well, one producer in particular who's a really great guy, and he just really believed in the music. So we all got together at his studio, and you can do it yourself, you know? You don't have to... And the good thing about doing it that way is you've got total and utter freedom to do exactly what you want.
So are you saying that you don't within the music industry? I mean, surely they're there just simply to take your music and to distribute it, and they make their money that way.
Well, I think, you know, you've only got to watch, like, music videos, you've only got to watch artists. The bigger the artist, the more they're smeared in a kind of veneer of glamour, which I think really is not their own, it's not coming from their own artistic expression, it's just something that's what sells, is that slick, sort of glamorous lifestyle, and it's the lifestyle that's being sold, not the art, it's not the music, it's this unattainable
kind of realm that that all the kids want to live in, and people, retarded adults, want to live in, and that's what they're really worshipping.
Okay. You talk about the word worship. Michael, do you think it's fair to say that there's a sort of iconic thing to do with celebrity in the music world? I mean, maybe not just the music world, particularly music, though, where it's almost like the young people particularly are kind of almost worshipping these celebrities because, kind of gods out of fashion, yeah, and that kind of thing. Do you think it's true that these people are kind of almost like mythological figures?
Definitely,
for youngsters?
Definitely. I mean, that's how they're portrayed and they're built that way, and they're pushed to the youngsters specifically to make them buy into certain trends, like, and so it's like, yeah, they are like it is the way they go on within the industry. It's like they make you look to something which is really unobtainable for like the normal average person, which is like on the street, like, you know.
Going back to you, Tim, you mentioned earlier on that you have some friends who were signed with Warners. Why on earth would you want to... I mean, they weren't happy with it. So what's the story about that? Why weren't they happy with what was going on at Warners?
Well, they worked for Warners, so they worked in A&R for Warners.
A&R stands for?
Artist and Repertoire, I think.
Okay.
They're the people that go and find acts and sign them up and all the rest of it. And I think these big record companies that are merging into one big entity now of having to make a lot of cuts, and they either chose to leave or they had to leave or something. You know, they left anyway, but they wanted to find the kind of music and the bands that they wanted to promote, and not be at the behest of some kind of corporate agenda to find a certain type of person who wants a certain type of lifestyle who's going to represent music that they're actually not really going to have much control over in the end. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, now, you've brought some of your music along.
Yeah.
I don't think it's fair, really, to be chatting about music without hearing some. So, can you just introduce the song that you've brought?
Well, this is a track called You've Got a Horus Out of Control. Check it. It's a cult. It's all a cult these days. Whack it on. I'm fighting a cult with a cult. Here we go. That was You've Got a Horus Out of Control, and Horus certainly is out of control right now. Check your Egyptology.
So what is Horus?
Horus is the, you know when you see all, like, Lady Gaga and Jay-Z and everybody doing that one eye thing, looking for the eye of the triangle? That's the eye of Horus.
Now that's from Egyptian Egyptian religion, I suppose, or mythology or whatever, from thousands of years ago. Why is that significant today?
Well, I just, like, these, all these multi-billion dollar invested pop industry acts are all doing this, using this symbology, and you've only got to look.
Okay, that's easy to say, but can you tell me some specific examples of where you can see this occult symbolism today in the music business?
Yeah, just have a look at the, there's one video that will just blow your mind. It's called Power, and it's by Kanye West, or Kanye West, or however you explain it.
I see Michael nodding away to that one.
Kanye West. Well, okay. He certainly can, because just check out his video Power. It's an absolute. It's just a tribute to occult Freemasonic imagery, and it's called Power, directed by a guy called Marco Brambilla.
But he's not that famous, is he? Surely.
He's massive.
Is he?
Huge.
Is he? Okay.
Huge.
Well, I'm not heard of him.
Multi-billion-dollar artist.
Okay. What about some artists that are really big that everyone would have heard of that use some of this symbolism?
Lady Gaga. Lady Gaga is continuously using these themes of. It's kind of like, it used to be just materialism and promiscuity, but it's now expanded into occult symbolism and mind control and transhumanism themes. And this is all leads back to what seems to be an obsession with what's, you know about MK Ultra and all that stuff, the CIA.
Well, this is the American intelligence drug program, mind control program, isn't it? Yeah, which has actually been proven, can't beyond any shadow of a doubt now,
to
have been taking place, where people were given drugs against their will without being told, and this kind of thing, and it was used. Basically, they used sort of like sort of animal. Dr. Mengele style experimentation by the Central Intelligence Agency. Anyway, what is there a general conspiracy theory regarding the occult in the music industry today?
If there is, then it's all based around this idea that there is a massive global move towards a centralized power structure in the world, and the entertainment industry, politics, big business, all of it is moving towards this agenda, this goal.
Yeah, well, one of the things that frustrates me is I know certainly during the 1960s and 70s, during the anti-Vietnam movement, etc., there was loads and loads of protest songs. Well, we don't really see, you know, generally being played on Radio 1, etc., protest songs about the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, and that kind of thing, do we? So, you know, is that really a conspiracy, or is it just coincidence, Tim?
I think that people are not particularly that interested in people, like attention span seems to have gotten very short, and we're so wound up in our own lives, so to speak.
So what got you interested in all this stuff?
What got me interested in it? I've always been a musician, I've always been interested in music, it's always had a huge effect on me. I've always been, the changing of my own consciousness, the changing of my own state has been paramount, primary to me, is the motivator of why I do anything, you know? And, of course, to cut a long story short, I ended up, the more I got into creating stuff and manipulating symbols and writing lyrics and stuff like this and researching stuff, the more I realized that I could change my own consciousness. That got me into Aleister Crowley stuff, all sorts of different occult experiments, because I had an obsession that I wanted to make my consciousness change in a psychedelic way, that the same sort of thing that you can do with drugs, without drugs. Can this be done? And I noticed that these themes are prevalent in a lot of what's going on at the moment. I wasn't the only one that was doing this, it seems. If this makes any sense to you, then that's great. But it's such a long story, Tony, that it's...
Okay, well, it sounds to me like you're going sort of really looking into the dark side there, but,
yeah.
I mean, don't you think it's possible that you could actually be seduced by the dark side as part of that journey?
Definitely.
And were you?
Well, the dark side of the journey is the fact that your wants and your desires, your clamour for prestige in the world and fame. If you look at Lady Gaga, it's all about, I want the fame. My brain's gone, but I've still got the fame. I've sold my soul for fame. That is the hook, if you like, and that is why so many people are just absolutely drawn towards
It's a kind of almost like a draw of some of almost immortality, isn't it? That if you're a famous person, your life is being documented, your music is being reproduced and sent all over the world.
Yeah.
Isn't this just a sort of
but it's all about
an overbearing ego that draws some people into this?
Pride. People get the word ego mixed up with pride, right? Ego is just a story that you tell yourself of who you are. It's pride that is manipulated by this dark force, if you like. You know, the Luciferian pride. This is Luciferianism, what we're talking about.
Now, what is Luciferianism?
It's like a very fast form of Buddhism. You know, like in Buddhism, you get the idea of enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
You're working towards a goal, which is enlightenment. If you do these certain spiritual practices, these certain meditation techniques, etc., you will have a mind. Your state of consciousness will change, and you will attain this mysterious state called enlightenment. Well, Luciferianism promises the same thing, but you just go through different spiritual techniques to get there.
Because, of course,
illumination.
Lucifer, at least the original Lucifer, was supposed to have been. This is before the creation of the earth in the mythology and in the Bible. He was supposed to have been God's favourite archangel, wasn't he? And Luciferianism is a faith of some sort that actually still sees Lucifer as up there, whereas actually, of course, in the biblical view, he was actually cast down by God. So it's a kind of in denial about whether Lucifer's a good guy or not.
Yeah, well, yeah, Buddhism, you've got Buddha. In Luciferianism, you've got Lucifer. Christianity, you've got Jesus.
Well, we're getting quite close here to thoughts of Halloween. So
yes.
I'm joined now by Marina Morris, who has a report to us for us all about Halloween. Marina.
Hello. The time between Halloween and Bonfire Night is often known in the UK as Mischief Week, when traditionally there is a rise of 16% in recorded criminal damage offences. The average number of crime recorded by Avon and Somerset Police Force in the 4 hours between 7 p.m. and midnight on Halloween is around 230. The local police are, in conjunction with trading standards, make check to ensure that fireworks are not being sold to children. Shops in and around Bristol have also agreed not to sell eggs and flour to children during this period. The message from Bristol City Council this year is, don't be a horror this Halloween, but you can have fun. Halloween is now a big business in the United States and Canada. The sales of pumpkins industry in the United States was more than $141 million in 2009. In 2007, the Council of the San Francisco banned the celebration because the previous year 9 people were shot during the festivities. This holiday is not popular in France, many Eastern European countries, and also in Russia. The origin of Halloween, the pre-Christian Celtic festival of the dead, appears to have existed in Celtic Britain more than 2,000 years ago and symbolized the beginning of the Celtic New Year. The Celts believe that the year has two major parts, winter and summer, with a festival marking the change. Summer being symbolic of the light and life, winter represents death and darkness. In the 19th century, Halloween spread from the UK to America and afterwards to other countries around the world. In the 19th century, in 1908, on the last Sunday in October, Britain decided to use this divided year to save electricity and change from summertime to wintertime. This year, Halloween is also the last Sunday of October, and now the clocks go back in hour in 110 countries through the globe, which copy the UK. Finally, the 31st of October in Ukraine is not only significant as Halloween and the time change. It is also the day of the local council election. Typically, Ukrainians will not celebrate Halloween because they are aware of the negative impact of this day, but they can have fun and they must fight for their future in an election. Everyone is watching. This election will be a test bed for new electoral systems.
Well, wise Eastern Europeans. And Marina, you've been out and about on the streets of Bristol this week to find out what our listeners, that's you, the people of Bristol, think about Halloween. So let's have a listen to that, and then afterwards we'll see what our musician friends, our guests in the studio, make of that.
Do you celebrate Halloween?
Not really. I did more so in a foreign country, in Mexico, and it's called Day of the Dead because it seems to be more celebrated there, whereas here it's not celebrated in the same way, I don't see. We like to use it as another excuse, more as a marketing tool for selling things rather than actually enjoying what it's about, because I don't think anyone really knows what it's truly about.
It's really over, yeah, it's really overhyped. And at the end of the day, you're celebrating evil, really, aren't you? I remember last year, actually, I was speaking to a policeman, and he said on Halloween he made 5 arrests alone, him personally. And I think it's just people think that they can just get away with stuff because it's Halloween. It's because parents let their kids go out as well in the evening when they probably wouldn't on a normal day. The kids are out, able to do whatever they want, and there's peer pressure, a lot of it.
I'm going to take the children to have a party on Friday night.
Pumpkins.
Yeah.
Pinatas.
Sweets.
Yeah, loads of sweets.
I do think that Halloween should be just kept inside, and if people want to celebrate, they can have little parties, but I don't think it should be children knocking at people's doors this day and age. I think it's too dangerous. And with the youngsters, as they are these days, unfortunately, they do tend to cause trouble, which isn't a happy time.
Yeah, I agree. Flower bombs and eggs and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, it spoils the fun out of it, I think.
Hi, I'm a Christian. I don't think the roots of it are what I agree with. So, I don't mind some aspects of it, but I wouldn't kind of celebrate it myself. I think originally it was for All Saints Day, so it was kind of getting all the bad stuff done before the All Saints Day. So, it's kind of I think the kind of stuff that it celebrates is not great. But then it's also just become quite commercialised and all.
I'm from Lithuania. Halloween? No, I don't. We have actually a little bit similar celebration, which is when the winter ends. People dress as like witches,
children, yes,
like witches, and they sing or say verse, and they get some sweets for it. So it's just similar.
Do you celebrate Halloween in Latvia?
Sometimes,
yes.
Mask and trick or treats, something like that.
Is it food in Latvia?
No. Yes.
But not in a massive way. My partner, he's got a 5-year-old boy, so he comes over and he just have a pumpkin, a little candle in it, and a little sweet, but that's all.
Do you know the origins of Halloween?
Well, that's the thing. I think if you're celebrating something, it's meaningless unless you know what the reasons behind it are. It's less celebrated in the same way. It's just another excuse for a party, really, otherwise.
I'm sure someone's made up. It's All Hallows Eve, isn't it? Christians don't celebrate. Christians are really against it, aren't they? It's not important, is it, really? It's come over from America, isn't it? It was such a big thing in America, and we just copy everything America do, so we've made it big here.
No, I don't really. No, I don't. Mums of a certain age, and with children of a certain age, get carried away and get pushed into... It's Halloween, you must celebrate. So I'm not that into it personally myself, but because I've got 2 young children...
We just tend to join in for the party and a few drinks. But the meaning of it, really, I think it's come over from America, and sometimes it's forgotten.
Yeah, it's from America, isn't it?
Maybe in America?
I think it's come from America, I think.
Yes, like many things these days, Halloween is from America. Although it went over there, I suppose, originally with the settlers, or at least All Hallows Eve went over there with America. Now, Michael Jenkins from Animal Trap, hip-hop band. What are your thoughts about Halloween? Are you going to be celebrating it this weekend?
No, I mean, I don't participate in anything like that. I mean, because I've got some myself, and I don't see that as anything positive that I'm bringing to him. And the way the country's monopolized off the whole Halloween, the whole celebration, is like, it just takes away from the actual meaning. Because I heard it was All Souls Day, All Saints Day, so it's like remembering the dead, sort of like. But the way it is now, it's like, yeah, you've got to spend money, buy sweets for the kids. It's just like, yeah, I'm just not into that whatsoever.
Anyway, going back to our discussion about the music industry, what do you think of Michael Jackson and Tupac and Biggie Smalls?
Yeah.
First of all, Michael Jackson.
Yeah, I mean, very, very big musical artist. I mean, great influence for me on music. And yeah, it's a shame what he ended up getting caught up in. So it's like, yeah, I mean, from that whole side of it, the whole control aspect on the people that are in control of his, of where they were pointing him and things like that. Same thing with Tupac and Biggie. They all died through some mysterious circumstances all surrounding their deaths. And Like, yeah,
now, Michael Jackson's sister, LaToya, has actually been saying right from day one that she believes he was murdered.
Yeah.
And why might that be? I mean, you know...
I see it as though he was about to make a lot of money without being controlled by them. So he was about to do a loads of tour, like a whole tour of the UK. So it's like he was about to make loads of money and be almost free from the system that has been taking him down for like the last 20 odd years, like, you know, so...
Well, he was singing a song, wasn't he, called They Don't Really Care About Us, yeah. Which was a very anti-establishment song. Do you think he was wise to be singing that?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it really helps him, like, in the long run, really. I mean, I think that video that he made for it, the original music video, got banned in a few countries because it was very political. It was very, it was a video shot of he was in a prison and he was getting the prisoners to almost, like, start a revolution. So it's like, they're not really into a big superstar like Michael Jackson portraying them sort of images to people and going away from the agenda which they've set for him, like, you know, which is what he was starting to do with songs like that.
Okay, what about Biggie Smalls and Tupac then?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of like a gang, well, what people say it was like a gang sort of thing, but I mean, they were both involved in certain, like, the contract that Tupac had with Death Row. He wasn't really feeling the whole movement of that clique, so it's like, he was looking to move away from that, and he was looking to start up his own political party because he wanted freedom for the indigenous people and the black people that were in America. So he was going down that route, but the people that are in control of him wanted him to go down a different route. So it was like, yeah, I mean, the killer, again, is very mysterious, the way that these people died and the way these people were murdered. Like, Tupac was murdered, Biggie Smalls was murdered, and no one was ever found out who done it. I mean, Tupac was killed in the middle of a desert in Las Vegas, like, so, I mean, but there was no witnesses, no reports. I mean, this happened on a Saturday night after a big Mike Tyson fight, so it's like, it's a big conspiracy surrounding the way they died in the first place, so it's like, yeah.
Do you think it's going too far to say that, well, it's okay to be a celebrity and a superstar in the music business so long as you don't start singing the wrong songs?
Well, I mean, by the looks of it, that's the way they don't want, the agenda is they don't want certain people, they want to have influence. The perfect way to have influence over young people is with music through popular culture. So it's like, if certain idols that are in this culture, they start preaching a different message to one that they want preached, it's like you get into dangerous territory, like, you know, definitely.
Now, also joined by James McEwen from High Fiction Science, as a local band. Hi, James.
Okay.
Now, can you just give us your experience in the music industry and in the music business? I mean, we've got some of your music we're going to hear a little bit of in a minute, but what's your experience of actually trying to get that music out to a wider audience?
Well, it's quite difficult to do. I mean, we're all in full-time employment, so it's not like we're full-time musicians.
But that shouldn't matter if it's good music you're putting together, should it?
It shouldn't do. No, you're quite right. And certainly we try and promote it as much as possible in these sort of ways and through the internet and things like that. But it's certainly very hard to get to any level where you're getting decent exposure. Even kind of blogs and stuff online are often sort of run by promoters and promotion companies behind those.
Oh, I see. So it might look like it's just being run by an individual, but actually...
Yeah, that's right. It's made to look kind of very bespoke and very sort of low-key, but in fact there's a lot of money being made from it and to actually sort of promote music in that way.
What about, because the local radio, BBC, run this thing called, is it BBC Introducing? What's your experience of them?
Yeah, we've not had a great deal of success there, unfortunately. I mean, we've sent music to them to try and use them as a gateway to get into the BBC and then hopefully get greater exposure, ideally on a station like sort of Six Music, which would probably suit our music the best. But they've been sort of fairly reluctant to give us any exposure, which is a bit of a shame at the moment, but hopefully we can change that.
Okay, well, let's have a little listen to some of your music now.
Not
That's a little bit of a snippet of Fleance there from High Fiction Science, and James McEwen, the artist, is joining me now. James, what about this internet download culture? Is that one of the reasons why young bands like yours, or new bands like yours, are not just simply not being picked up by the industry?
The music industry itself is in a kind of a state of flux at the moment, I think, because there's just such a wide proliferation of different genres and so many people actually making their own music now. I think the music industry doesn't really know how to tackle that, and it doesn't know how to sort of best promote something other than a physical product.
But the thing is, we've got literally thousands and thousands and thousands of hours a week of radio around the country where the music is being played, but it seems that it's all the older stuff that's being played. Why might that be?
Yeah, I guess they get greater revenue from stuff that's already established. There's not so much of a drive to promote new music. There's probably a very limited remit within the BBC to actually do that. And so that could be part of the reason, I guess.
And what about just generally the music scene in Bristol? What's your experience? I mean, is it easy for you to get gigs? Is it easy for you to find new musicians if you want to add them to your band or change the way you're doing things?
Yeah, it's amazing really what a small city Bristol is in some respects. Yeah, there's a very healthy, vibrant music scene that is kind of almost under the radar in a lot of respects. A lot of the gigs that we play and the musicians that we work with and producers that we work with kind of exist on a sort of an alternative level, really, slightly below the radar, maybe.
And it's finally, is there anywhere we can see your band coming up soon, or where can we find you on the internet?
Yeah, you can find us on the internet at myspace.com/ High Fiction Science. That's HI Fiction Science. And we're playing Salisbury Arts Centre on the 20th of November.
Lovely, right, that's right around the corner from where I used to work, with a little BBC studio just around the corner from the Arts Centre, and I saw John Martin there years ago, for what it's worth, and he spat on me, and I didn't wash my face for about a day and a half. Anyway, thanks very much, guys. Now, this weekend sees the annual meeting of the Bromsgrove Group in Birmingham. This is one of the longest-running and most well-represented monetary reform groups in the world, and has been predicting the current financial crisis for decades. Entirely unreported in the mainstream media, they do not just bemoan the problem, but offer well-thought-through practical solutions to our financial crisis. Anyway, earlier this week, I caught up with one of the speakers at this year's Bromgrove Conference, former US newspaper manager, now turned author and alternative economist filmmaker, Bill Still.
My name is Bill Still, and I live just outside of Washington, D.C., in the Virginia suburbs, and my new film is called The Secret of Oz. It's the sequel to The Money Masters. I've been looking for a way to tell the monetary reform story in shorter fashion ever since I produced The Money Masters, which was released in 1996, because it comes in at 3 hours and 23 minutes, and that's really just too long for most people to sit through the story. So I've always been looking for a new way to do it. And when I discovered the wonderful Wizard of Oz connection, in other words, the original book version, and how that was filled, laden with monetary reform symbolism, I immediately jumped on it. I was surprised that I hadn't heard it before, but it's been a topic of a professional paper writing in the economics community for nearly two decades. And so as soon as I saw that, you know, there was legit research behind it, I jumped right on it and made a new film, which comes in at a little over 100 minutes, which is much more consumable for the average person.
Can you tell us about the various symbols, then, in The Wizard of Oz that you believe actually have some sort of monetary significance and how they relate to the characters, for example?
Well, the most important symbolism was destroyed when the 1939 movie was made, and so that's why we really don't know about that. When the 39 movie was made by MGM with Dorothy and the ruby slippers, it was actually the ruby slippers that were the culprit. They changed, the original color of the slippers was silver, and that brought forth the symbolism of the silver slippers on the gold road. And what that meant was silver at that point was from the bottom up alternative to increasing the money supply, whereas the bankers had a gold only money system that they could control quite completely and impoverish people in general, and thereby cause the deepest and the most lengthy depression in American history, the post Civil War depression, because they were able to keep silver out of the money supply and make it a gold only system.
So you're saying the yellow brick road really was the gold brick road?
Yes. In the book version, the yellow brick road was not a good thing. It was a dangerous road that could only be traversed when Dorothy had on the magical silver slippers. And of course, that was, at any point, she could escape from her travails by clicking the heels of her silver slippers together three times. And what that meant was that America, unbeknownst to most of the population, could escape the depression merely by adding additional money to the system, just like you in your own personal life. You can escape your financial travails if someone stuck a bunch of extra money in your pocket. Of course, we can do that, and we can do it without debt, and that is the problem right now. Our system is entirely not only laden with debt, but based on debt, and we can never get out of debt because of that, and that's why all these austerity measures that are currently being enforced on Britain will absolutely never work, because the debt and the interest caused by the debt is way too big, and the austerity that you can actually cut out of a system is way too small, and so eventually this system will still collapse.
But haven't we been running debt for decades, if not hundreds of years?
Yes, absolutely. But the system has now reached something that economists are calling for the first time debt saturation, where the interest on the debt has just become so huge. For example, in the United States, I don't know the British situation, but in the United States, the interest paid on the debt is greater than the total discretionary spending of the United States Congress every year. In other words, all the stuff that we argue about, oh, we're spending too much money on bridges to nowhere, blah, 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 you may have heard. All of that is exceeded by the interest we pay mostly to bankers on our money, the interest on the national debt, a totally unnecessary expenditure. We don't have to do it that way. We don't have to have our money based on debt. And a nation, the thing that makes a sovereign nation sovereign is that it can create its own money without debt. It's a scam that bankers essentially have perpetrated on us that we don't need and is now killing the system, and it's killing it worldwide.
So how does that relate to the silver slippers and the gold brick road in The Wizard of Oz?
Because at that point, silver could not be controlled because it was being mined so prodigiously in the western United States. And so it was an addition to the money supply that was outside of the control of the bankers. Now, of course, the addition of silver money would not do anything because silver is now traded electronically by high-frequency trading, etc. It's no different from anything else. The only thing that will relieve us from our problem right now is to stop issuing our money at debt. Stop government borrowing. Stop this tremendous debt-based economy.
You can't stop government borrowing, surely, because then they won't have any money to spend.
No, you absolutely can. Those are the two great pillars upon which monetary reform is absolutely based. No more government borrowing. The thing that makes a nation sovereign is that it does not borrow it, its money. It creates it without debt.
So what you're saying is essentially that, similar to what quite a lot of other economists have been saying in Britain, is that what we need to be doing is this printing of money or quantitative easing, only making sure that that money is used directly by the government and spent into the economy rather than given to the banks as it is at the moment.
Absolutely. A nation does not have to borrow its money into existence. That is the essence of what makes a nation a sovereign nation. The borrower shall be servant to the lender. Why, if you want to call your nation sovereign, would you want to indebt it to bankers? No, because if you're indebting it to bankers, then bankers, by definition, will use that money to buy into the political system and thereby control the political system. There's a word for that in political science. It's called plutocracy, not democracy.
Rule by the rich.
Rule by the rich, that's correct. That's what we have now. You have a plutocratic system disguised as a democratic system.
What about some of the other symbolism in the Wizard of Oz then? The Scarecrow, the Tin Man, the Lion. Do they have any kind of significance for the monetary reformers or not?
Well, yeah, it all told the monetary reform story. You know, the Scarecrow represented the Midwestern farmers who were hit hardest by the depression of the post-Civil War depression, and they were thought to be brainless. But the secret of money is not that difficult once you understand it. And so the Scarecrow actually ended up ruling Oz in the book. Not that he was the smartest one, but, you know, anyone with half a brain, once you understand the secret of Oz, can understand what the problem is and fix it.
Okay, what about the Lion and the Tin Man then?
Well, the Lion represented William Jennings Bryan. Of course, Bryan just coincidentally happens to rhyme with Lion. Bryan was the greatest orator of his time and the greatest proponent of monetary reform of his time. And when he was defeated in the 1896 presidential election, then L. Frank Baum, who wrote the book version, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, saw that monetary reform was dead, that the bankers had won. And so, to me, he wrote The Wonderful Wizard of Oz just like he was firing a flare up into the night sky of history, hoping that someone down the road would pick up on these symbols and recover the monetary reform thought, and that's what we've done.
And the Tin Man?
The Tin Man represented the industrial worker, and there are a lot of symbols like that, and I kind of touch on them, but really the essence is the monetary reform platform.
So fundamentally, there's a problem with banking, and that is that bankers lend out money that they don't actually have. How did that come about historically?
It's a great gig if you can get it. If you or I actually lent money at interest that we didn't have, I believe that's called counterfeiting or fraud or both, and we'd be immediately thrown into jail. But when you're a banker and you can do it, you can get away with it. And, of course, it's in the banker's interest to try to keep the politicians from making that a crime. And that's exactly what they've been able to successfully do. So we have a two-pronged problem, and that is we have nations borrowing money. That's a problem that has to be fixed. And we have banks lending money that they don't actually have. If you fixed those two problems, then you fix the economic system, and nothing else will fix the economic system. Until we address those problems, this is going to go nowhere but down, I can assure you.
Now, if you go back a thousand years, the only kinds of money that were around were gold, and then over the years the bankers, goldsmiths, started to use pieces of paper to represent the gold, because paper was more convenient, it wasn't really heavy. They were keeping the people's deposits in gold, but then they could trade that gold using those bits of paper. How did the bankers then start issuing actually more bits of paper than they had gold in their coffers?
They just did it. It was a fraud. The temptation is way too great. If you have a gold repository and you're issuing pieces of paper to represent the gold, it's way too easy, especially if you're loaning out these pieces of paper and getting interest back. It's way too easy to overissue pieces of paper because it's in your financial interest to do it. And the problem was that back in 1100 AD, King Henry, the son of William the Conqueror, was the first one to actually do something about this scam. And he decided that the goldsmiths, by either lending out their pieces of paper liberally or refusing to lend them out, could affect the entire national economy. They could cause boom times, good times, by lending out liberally, throwing more money into the economy, or they could cause depressions by contracting that money supply. And the problem with it was that thereby they controlled the politics of the nation. They could go into the king and say, look, we don't like this policy that you're doing. If you continue, we're going to cause a depression. Because they had discovered that the goldsmiths never got the blame for the depression. They could always push the blame off on the sovereign or the politician. And so thereby they controlled the politics of the nation. So that's why King Henry invented tally sticks, which was basically the form of money upon which the British Empire was built for some 700 100 years, and that broke the back of the goldsmiths, put more money into the hands of the common person and took it away, the money power, away from the bankers. And this is what led to the empowering of the middle class that brought on the whole rise of the arts, etc., in Britain. And it was a good thing. It was,
so what is a tally stick?
A tally stick was basically just a stick of hazelwood that was polished and split down the middle. Notches were cut into the stick before it was split, and then when it was split, you had two halves that were identical, that when they were put back together, it was impossible to counterfeit, in other words, and the king kept one half and spent the other half into the economy, paid for things. And how do you pay for things with a stick?
Yeah, good question. How do you?
Well, it's very simple. You declare the tally stick to be good for the payment of taxes. And so everyone had, there's a built-in demand for the tally stick. Well, we've got to get some of those tally sticks because that's the only thing we can pay our taxes with. And so it circulated as money. And it was money without debt created strictly by the government for the benefit of all people equally in the public interest. That's what money should be. That's the most important thing that should be in the public interest, the issuance of money.
So, for example, people in Bristol here running things like Let Schemes, creating these little local currencies, if those local currencies were good for the payment of local taxes, then they would actually be, in a way, a kind of parallel system, and they would be picked up and used more, do you think?
Yes, that's right. Competing currencies is probably a good way to go.
Going back to the Bank of England then, what role has the Bank of England played in all this? Because I think many people are a bit puzzled when they see the Queen's head on banknotes and coins. To what extent is this actually controlled by the government and by our politicians, our elected politicians, and to what extent is it actually controlled by the city?
The formation of the Bank of England was originally the thing that started to bring down the tally stick system and bring back the system of government indebtedness. 1694, I believe, 1696, I forget the exact date. But in any case, within 50 years, government borrowing through the Bank of England system had risen to such an extent that 75% of British taxes went just to paying interest on this new national debt. That's money totally siphoned out of the economy, siphoned into the hands of the bankers, thereby empowering the bankers both financially, and they use that money in turn to get politicians elected, so it perpetuates the system, and that's the system we have today.
Also, what about the role of the Rothschild family?
Yes, the Rothschilds were very important in the creation of this fractional reserve lending system and the domination of banks lending money to governments.
So what is fractional reserve then?
No, a fractional reserve is where banks get to lend money they don't actually have. And theoretically, in the United States, they've been held to a 10% reserve requirement. In other words, they can lend out $9 for every $1 that they hold in reserves. However, we found out with the crash in 2008 that no one had been adhering to that reserve requirement. The big banks were leveraged 50-1. Freddie and Fannie were leveraged 72-1. Goldman Sachs, the big investment bank, was leveraged 333-1.
So they were lending out £300 for every £1 that they had in deposit. Now, that sounds like fraud, doesn't it?
Well, of course it's fraud. It's fraud of the worst kind because it robs you and I every second that they do it. It's sucking money out of the economy, consolidating it into the hands of these big bankers for their own use.
But
and, of course, they use that money to perpetuate themselves politically.
But surely they're actually creating lots of money and spending that into the economy, which is a good thing.
Oh, well, it may be a good thing except for one little thing, and that's they're doing it at interest. And they're skimming off the interest. And that's not the system we need. We can return that functionality to the government itself. They can issue all the money they want without debt and in the public interest. That's the system we should have. That's the system we don't have. The system we do have is one that's disguised to be the right system. That's why all these national central banks are called Bank of England, Bank of France, etc., the Federal Reserve System, to give them the concept that this is your national bank, or issuing the money in the national interest. And that's why if you ask the average person on the street in the United States who issues the money, they'll think it's a trick question, but when they finally get around to answering, they'll say, well, it's the government. That's what it's supposed to make you think is happening. But it's not the government that's issuing the money. It's the big banks. And the Fed is just there to make it appear that they're controlling the big banks, but they really aren't.
So how did Nathan Rothschild make so much money at the Battle of Waterloo, out of the battle?
By communications. He was able to use his money to get news of the victor at the battle before anyone else, and so he was able to play the stock market appropriately and win big.
So where do you see the present economic crisis going? It's someone that's studied money for quite a while now, Bill.
It's going to, their job is merely to decrease the slope of the spiral downwards so that hopefully we don't get too agitated about it. They can't stop it at this point. The interest on the debt is siphoning off way too large a percentage. And so it's going to do nothing to spiral in downwards until we're none of us have jobs and we're all serfs and totally dependent on government for everything.
That was Bill Still, with a pretty grim prospect. But, of course, they are now just arriving at the Bromsgrove Group Conference up just outside Birmingham at the moment, where they will be discussing exactly what to do about it, as they have been discussing for decades. And so the next time you hear anyone in the press saying, oh, but we never expected this financial crisis to happen, then you know that actually that is, in fact, a lie. That was former US newspaper manager turned monetary reformer Bill Still, and he was talking to me earlier this week. And his new film is called The Secret of Oz, which you can find on the internet. You can actually watch it on YouTube for free, or else, if you want to, you can buy it from his Secret of Oz website. So, thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, who didn't manage to make it because her car broke down. But anyway, we wish her well. That's Councillor for Whitchurch Park and leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, Helen Holland. Thanks also to Marina Morris, as a reporter, and Adrian Connock for his report on the 7-7 inquests. Thanks also to Michael from the Typical Topical Afro-Tropical News Show, and musicians Tim Herford and James McGowan. To writer, money expert and filmmaker, you just heard there, Bill Still. But last but not least, to our resident old Labour economist, Martin Summers. Next week, well, we must be crazy. Conservative councillor Peter Abrahams, unfortunately, has cancelled, but we'll find someone else, and we're going to do this all over again. That's enough talk for tonight, because Friday night is music night. Coming up next, it's the sample show with Johnny, our very own turntable terrorist. At 8, it's Matt and Dan's Erotic Toast Project. 9, it's Permission to Dance with Josh and James. And top of the bill at 10, it's Mash Up to the Weekend, woven together by our mystic seamstress DJ Spungold. If you're on Broadband Internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including this program's 5-point economic recovery plan, report on mobile phones and wireless safety, an extended interview with managing editor of BBC Radio Bristol, Tim Pemberton, an investigation into leadership charity Common Purpose, as well as our 5th anniversary investigation into the 7/7 London bombings of 2005. Just go to This Week. .org.uk and click on the links to our archives. The podcast of this show is usually online by midnight after broadcast. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. And don't forget, the clocks go back on Saturday evening.
93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody...